Joining us at this time is Professor Robert Brown of Communications at Salem State University, but we're going to be talking politics. He's been immersed in politics for years. He's a delegate to the Massachusetts State Convention, Democratic State Convention, coming up next month and in June. And Professor, great to talk with you and great to have you with us today.
I'm delighted to be here, especially to talk about two of my favorite subjects, politics and sports.
Right. And that's what we have in the name of the website, News Sports. We should have politics, news and sports, and maybe that would be a little bit more entertaining. I want to start, first of all, let's just talk about what do you think is going to be happening, or what's at stake at the Democratic convention coming up in June in Massachusetts. We've got a bunch of other things to talk about, because this Democratic race all of a sudden looks a lot more exciting than the Republican race as of right now, anyways.
The convention in the state convention, which I thought when I was elected delegate running unopposed, I thought it was going to be very, very quiet, interesting, somewhat breakout sessions, sort of academic. It's not going to be that way. I probably am going to bring some boxing gloves, and maybe I'll strap a weapon to my chest, whether it's a conceal or carry or not. It's going to be very, very exciting and dramatic. We're living in the world of infotainment, and politics has become obsessively entertaining. It's been entertaining first on the Republican side, where we had that fascinating circus, and now the Republican side is, well, solidifying, some would say congealing, crystallizing around the hostile takeover, now the friendly takeover of the front runner. The Democrats have become the Hatfields and McCoys, firing at each other, death threats, and on both sides, posters being ripped off, cars being keyed. I am thinking of hiring a bodyguard to bring with me to the state convention.
It's definitely going to be very interesting. Now, you've written a lot in politics over the years, and you're working on an article now, The Election of Donald J. Trump. Now, you're a Democrat. You're writing this article, Election of Donald J. Trump. Tell us about where this article will appear, when it will appear, and then we're going to go into this election, of this so-called article, because some of the background behind it. But to, update us a little bit more on that that journal.
I write for a number of publications, sometimes for the Boston Globe. I just sent a piece to the Philadelphia Inquirer, written in the LA Times in Toronto. But this is an academic journal where in which academics, scholars on political communication, public relations to some extent, crisis communications, where they contribute scholarly pieces about the election, the culture around the election. And back in the winter, I began to realize I was asked to write a piece, and I came up with the title, which is The Election of Donald J. Trump. Whether that happens or not, this is not my prediction, but on the other hand, it is a way that I'm going to try to capture moments in history. And I think I'll go back to the implosion of the Whig Party in 1856, right up to and through the hand raising of Donald Trump at the August debate, the Fox debate, that famous Fox debate, and the 24 million people tuned into that. Moments which move us and helped historically to help us to understand how the politics in this country have changed over the years, and the continual tectonic earthquake nature of the way our politics have changed. In slowly, but profoundly, to the point now where we're in a Hitchcock movie, where we're living in a world of a political world of constant suspense and surprise. Hitchcock was the master of that, and we're living in Hitchcock's world now.
Following up on the article, so in the Trump piece here is that everyone got him wrong. Everyone got the thing wrong. All the Republican insiders, they all got it wrong. 16 candidates are now gone. There's just Donald J. Trump is remaining. And what were the steps that made that happen, or why do you think that happened?
Donald J. Trump is, to some extent, the creature of the discourse of talk radio. Talk radio, especially right-wing talk radio, which more or less is talk radio, has been a very powerful force in this country since the heyday of the Vietnam War. I was professor and then a corporate speech writer, a magazine editor and writer, contributing feature writer in Los Angeles in the 70s. Ronald Reagan became governor. Before that, there was a talk radio host who fomented the first, helped crystallize the Proposition 13, which here in Massachusetts is Proposition 2.5, tax reductions, all that excitement. All that energy, the political energy, way before reality television was a reality, was radio. Radio, which we're on now. Radio produced and generated that energy and the energy of people calling in. It became not a one-way medium, but a two-way medium and a multi-way medium. And it's become, and it's still extraordinarily important as part of the media landscape. And so this discourse, to be interesting, had to develop conflict. Conflict is what makes drama. Conflict, anger, rage, and the cultivation of rage, of outrage, is something that talk radio has done masterfully. Right-wing talk radio, very asymmetric from left-wing radio, the Rachel Maddow radio before she became an MSNBC star, left-wing radio was never nearly as enraging as right-wing radio. Right-wing radio has been fabulous for its conspiracy theories, its wildness, its fury, its opposition of science, and its revolutionary and reactionary and apocalyptic quality. We've seen nothing like this. It really has produced, it never produced a candidate who could take the national stage. The closest it came was Rush Limbaugh, who in 1988 crumpled a paper into a microphone when his local show went national. It was quite a moment.
Let's just crumple that paper right now for the listeners. There it is, that paper. That's it.
That was a moment. That was a moment that changed radio. He would remember that moment. Every once in a while he does that too. His rancor, his feminazis, his mocking of the liberal hearts, the feelings, singing feelings, nothing but feelings, mocking liberals and progressives for their phony, limousine, liberal, lying qualities. It's been fabulous. Now, I know as a Democrat who voted for Hubert H. Humphrey in 1968, and someone is a delegate to this Democratic convention, I'm really not supposed to say these things. I'm supposed to be someone whose politics, as a professor, whose politics that students would not know. They would not know. But I'm happy to cross that line and to be able to think historically and politically about what is so fascinating to me, which is the drama of what's going on now. And I would say another thing. There is a sense of apocalypticism, a sense of dystopia on the left, not on the right. The right is thrilled about this. The right is thrilled that they finally have a talk radio candidate who is a reality television candidate who is about the most famous person in the world at this moment, the most obsessively famous person in the world, whose name is on buildings he leases, who has taken over the news cycles masterfully, who is quote unquote authentic in an extraordinary way that no one has ever been, because he can take back anything that he says. The left is apocalyptic. The left is thinking apocalyptically and moving to Cape Breton and leaving the country, and it's a terrifying vision for the left. But for the right is exultant. In fact, the right is already thinking about Newt Gingrich, and should it be Newt Gingrich or should it be Rand Paul, who would be Trump's vice president, as Trump begins to already take over the White House. The left has begun to panic. Now the left is deeply schizophrenically conflicted between its two candidates, one who wants to, I quote, to deal a heavy blow, quote unquote, to Hillary Clinton, the Bernie Sanders side, believes that he can wrest the superdelegates from her. And at this point, who can predict that he can't do that? One of the two will be up against Donald Trump. One of those two, the most likely one, I would suppose, would be Hillary Clinton because of the math. We always hear this, but this fascinating election cycle is a time when we're living down the rabbit hole. With Alice, with tiny creatures and giant creatures, we never know what's going to happen.
You know, I have two thoughts to pick up on what you were saying, Rob. And one was, I remember one of my first introductions to talk radio was back probably in the late 60s, 70s, and it was Jerry Williams, but he was coming at it from the left, but he was angry from the left. He was against the war. He was talking about race. And then he flipped later on in life to move over to the right, to be the right angry guy. And I'm struck by that. But here's when you were talking, I thought about this, and it kind of finally came to me. And putting these, you know, you have these little thoughts in your head, and you're not able to crystallize them. But what Donald Trump has done is, like, he takes what the talk radio people are saying and puts it out there himself with that message. So you're into messaging. So he's the messenger of what they're saying. When in the past, think back, Mitt Romney. He would not go that way. He was part of the Republican system and would be the candidate that of the system and would have these protocols manners, so to speak, that he would not go into that region. John McCain, failed candidate on the Republican side, same thing. You know, played it straight down the middle, was the polite guy, wouldn't venture off into the discuss these kinds of things. But Donald Trump is the guy that is taking what he hears on talk radio, taking what he hears, sees, and putting it right into the mix, and then people have to report it, and then people are reacting to it. It's not like they're reacting to Howie Carr or any other talk, Sean Hannity on the radio. They're reacting to the actual candidate that's saying it.
I remember Jerry Williams. Every time I click my seatbelt off and give the middle finger to the authority, I think about Jerry Williams. I think Jerry Williams is also a guy I talked about, NIMBY, and building prisons out in New Braintree. Yeah. I remember him. He was a great activist for either side. He also did a very strange sex survey, didn't he?
He did it from the I want to say Cosmopolitan, but he yes. would do that survey every year.
Astonishing to listen to this guy on the radio ask women things that would actually get him arrested now in the times of trigger warnings and and misogyny, in the culture that we're in. He was really outrageous, and I think the point about drama, and I have to say that my first piece for American Behavioral Scientist was was about the drama of Kerry and Bush, and the way Bush did these fascinating things. Bush 43, he would not only shake your hand, but he with one hand, but with his other hand, he would rub you up and down on the back. He was all over you. He really was in a way that John Kerry, who was the trope about Kerry was that he was standoffish and French and overly sophisticated, and he twisted tilted in the wind. He went this way and that way. He was a patrician, whereas Bush was just kind of a regular guy that you just have a beer with, you know. Trump takes that, but in those election cycles, it was the rhinos against the wacko birds. It was the blue mask group wacko birds, the crazy left-wing socialist nuts like a Sanders, and on the other side, a Romney who was loathed and despised by the hard right. They hated him for being, for his Romney care and his Republican in name only rhino. It's the rhinos they hated. And now finally, it's not the rhinos versus the wacko birds. It's now the revolutionary socialist wacko birds, you know, versus the Trumpians, the populists. It's the progressive populists on the left and the hard right conservative or post-conservative populists on the right. And actually, Trump is an authoritarian populist. He's not a Cruz. He's not a conservative. However, the coalition, he's got the coalition around him now. Everyone will coalesce around Mr. Trump. The evangelicals, who are not at all a bloc. This is in some ways a contest between very angry white people on the left and very angry white people on the right. We used to have white flight, and now we have white fight.
Yeah, they've spread out all over the place. And as you were talking, I'm thinking about this. You mentioned the Kerry-Bush matchup and the likability piece. I am struck by all those skits on Saturday Night Live during that election in 2000. And so they basically paint Gore as this kind of, a little out of touch or a little, you know, just someone a little bit different. How about that? Just somebody a little bit different. They paint him that way. And there's this thing about, you know, well, you can't win unless you're liked. And Bush had some of that going for him. And what about, how do you think the likability piece or the Saturday Night Live piece is playing right now? Because they seem to be able, well, they give it to everybody. But, I mean, I think that Hillary is still kind of pilloried sort of on Saturday Night Live.
I like Hillary pillory. The T-shirts, there's a lot of mocking fun. If you can remove yourself for a moment. You go to a Trump rally and there are T-shirts that say Hillary for jail, all of that. This is a infotainment, reality television, talk radio culture. This is a world in which the politicians are doing their best to be entertaining, and the most entertaining people win. I did a Rotary talk, a local Rotary talk. I was asked to by the university's communications department before the last election, last presidential election, and I said I think between Romney and Obama, the best actor will win, and it turned out that Obama was a better actor than Romney. There are a lot of other reasons for that. So, but I've always, from the days that I saw how well Bush connected with people and how poorly Kerry connected, I know we're living in the age of algorithms and 538.com and polls and polling. But we know we see these things shifting. Look at California now, for example. It's fairly close in California, the Democratic side, with Sanders and Clinton. Clinton's a little ahead. It doesn't really matter that much because the events are so tectonic, so earthquake-like. The thrill, the excitement, the suspense, it exerts a kind of force on these polls and changes things enormously. We've seen the lack of predictability of these polls early on, and we're about to enter. We haven't even entered the formal beginning of the general election, and I can't sit here and really say that other than believing at least that Donald Trump is going to get that nomination in Cleveland, which is going to be a very boring, quiet, everyone's going to put their RPGs away and their guns, they'll have them strapped to themselves, they'll sneak in, and no one will shoot anyone there. It's going to be a love fest. It's going to be feelings, and there will be Republicans loving each other. And the Democratic convention is going to be paintball.
Yeah. You know, you're right. And one of the things I'm struck with, I'm kind of a news junkie, and I watch the news, or I'll watch the elections. I might watch the news channels on primary nights we've had the last several months and so on, and watching it. And I'm struck by how kind of narrow focus the reaction is on these given nights. In other words, there was this narrative out there, as you were alluding to or spoke very directly to, that the two conventions were going to be polar opposites of what they now look like they're going to be. And yet, I was thinking all along that this is a possibility, is that I didn't predict it, but I'm just saying there's a very good chance this will be flip-flopped, you know. But yet, this narrative that we had a month ago was just the opposite. And I'm just, you know, you're again into messaging and reading the messages and trying to understand that, yeah, that everything changes after an event happens. You know, the world was not the same the day after 9/11. Everything changed. And it's the same with these elections, is that, you know, like, and how we report it. What is the news story out of last Tuesday? Hillary Clinton wins Kentucky. Bernie Sanders wins Oregon. You go on. Is there a big message out of that? Probably not. But what the big message was is that there's now all of a sudden it could be a fight in Philadelphia.
I think all of that is so. I think it probably will be a fight in Philadelphia. I think that's fairly logical.
Excuse me.
But what I'm fascinated with are moments, optics. A term in communications, optics. What things look like, and one of the most interesting visuals of the last day or two has been the visit, Donald Trump's visit with Henry Kissinger. We don't see Henry Kissinger because he's in a secret bunker. He can't really leave the United States because there are many nations which would have him on trial as a war criminal. But what's Kissinger, of course, famously was the realpolitik strategist. His understanding was that nations do not have friends. Nations have interests. And that means that things can change and turn around in a moment. The idea of right now on the table is, what do we do with a foreign policy? And in a way, some people say that we elect a president for foreign policy. They take credit for the economy, or take the blame for the economy. Bush 41 was blamed for the downturn that got Clinton elected, and Obama is still taking it, even though Massachusetts has a 4.2% unemployment rate for slow growth and all of that. But how about foreign policy? So when Trump made his foreign policy speech, as it were, and said that we have to have a new paradigm, we have to get beyond NATO and CETO and all those kind of pacts, well, people in the Council of Foreign Relations and policy experts, well, they freaked out. They totally freaked out. And here is Trump now trying to figure out, how do I play this? I said this. It sounds like fun. It sounds exciting. Trump's managed to be both. It's so fascinating, both an isolationist and a carpet bomber. You can be a carpet bomber and an isolationist. Let's say Chris Christie, who's on the short list for vice president, Big Christie. Chris, not very popular in his own state, but Chris Christie, who talked about carpet bombing, going to Raqqa, the capital, so to speak, of ISIS, and carpet bombing. At the same time, you have a Rand Paul, who is also on the short list. He's a kind of neo-isolationist in a way, like his dad, saying, not quite. He wouldn't like that term, I understand that. But we shouldn't get involved with all these people. You see, now we are involved. It's really hard not to continue to be involved. So you have a Trump campaign, which manages to be not Euclidean geometry, where parallel lines, if you remember from high school, can never meet in geometry. Then there was this Lobachevsky. He came along and say, no, in outer space, parallel lines can meet. An isolationist in the Trump world can be. An isolationist in the talk radio world can be one and the same with a carpet bomber. You can be a carpet bomber and an isolationist all in one. It's amazing. It's amazing to have that kind of logic. And that is the logic of reality shows and talk radio, especially of talk radio. Reality shows are mostly about people losing a huge amount of weight and then quietly gaining it back, quietly gaining most of it, all of it back. We know this from medical research, because the body says, no, I'm sorry, you're not going to starve me anymore and lift weights for every single day for 1,000 days. I'm glad you lost 150 pounds. I'm going to make you gain 175 pounds. How do you like that? Because our bodies are smarter than we are and smarter than reality television. No, it's talk radio, which has fomented both isolationism and carpet bombing and anything that comes along, because it's exciting. We want drama. We want conflict. And now we have an exultant right, which is already picking the cabinet. As far as the exultant right is concerned, Donald Trump has already been elected president of the United States. And they're loving the food fight, the nastiness that's going on pre-Philadelphia. That will be the apocalypse of the Democratic Party as they see it, and it will make the wacko birds go away completely. And you're going to have a fascinating general election. So what we're seeing is parallel lines in politics crossing. Parallel lines cross in the outer space of our apocalyptic politics, and Trump has glued to himself the unlikely coalition of conservatives, certain wings of evangelicals, wonky types like Paul Ryan and others, who are happy to get together, just like Russia and Germany and the von Ribbentrop Pact and the pacts of the really unlikely allies, because in war and in politics, the logic is about winning, and I think this is what the Trump campaign has brought to a head. That this is the strategy. The strategy is win at all costs, and that's what they've done.
Yeah. So I'm thinking here, this will be the first election ever that we don't have a winner and a loser, but somebody will get voted off the island. That's how it's going to end up, and that's probably how the country will think about it, or elements of the country will think about it. Hey, so let's stop politics. I'm going to maybe one final question. Let's talk sports. So you know, what, well, that's another big love of yours. But and I want you to share one story with us in a moment as well here, if you could. But just one thing on sports. What's got your attention here? Is it our Red Sox, or what else is piquing your interest in sports right now, Dr. Brown?
Well, I guess true to my nature, the neo-authenticity. I don't believe in authenticity, but neo-authenticity. I grew up a Mickey Mantle fan.
You did believe that until you met me. Now you don't believe in authenticity. That changed everything.
That did change me. That did change me, Bill. I was a New York kid, and I grew up in the golden age of New York City baseball, which was American baseball. In the sixth grade, Miss O'Brien, our teacher, stopped class before 2 o'clock so we could listen to the World Series. The World Series was always about the Yankees and or the Dodgers and or the Giants for years. I grew up a Yankee fan from 1950 when they beat the Phillies till when I was in college. They were in every World Series but 58, 54 they weren't in, the Indians were, 58, I think 59 was the White Sox. They were in for every, about, with the exception of maybe two or three. I was completely absorbed and a tremendous Mickey Mantle fan. Well, I came to Boston and I suffered terribly. Because my son was one, and I said, you cannot grow up here and be a Yankee fan. I will not. This will not be allowed. Just the optics would be terrible for you. You will be a hated person. I'm going to take you to Fenway, and he and I shared the baseball card world, and the Wade Boggs world, and the Roger Clemens world, And in 86, when the ball rolled through Bill Buckner's legs, I became a blood brother of Red Sox Nation. And I am as rabid a Red Sox fan as I ever was a Yankee fan. Now, my relatives in New York, who are rabid Yankee fans, they don't believe me. They cannot believe that I would not only abandon the Yankees, but do the Johnny Damon thing, go from the Red Sox to the Yankees, to the Roger Clemens thing, go from the Red Sox, where he wears Red Sox cap in the Hall of Fame, to, well, he won't get in for a while, I suppose, to become a Yankee ace. But I'm perfectly happy doing this. I root for the Red Sox. I root against Roger Goodell. I have a good friend who works for the NFL, and I just love that. I love him, Tom Brady, coming in helicopter to Salem State. That was a wonderful optics moment. Great press conference, too. This is so much fun. And I'm a Celtics fan. My brother grew up in New York and is a Yankee fan and all of that, but then his friends at Penn said, you got to come up to watch the Celtics with Bill Russell. And he became a rabid Celtics fan when he was in New York, still in New York. He's a New Yorker, a classic Steinberg cartoon New Yorker, and a rabid Celtics fan. And I am a rabid Celtics fan, too. So, and as well, we have a hockey culture. I don't know if you know this. Salem State really isn't so much a baseball culture, a football culture, it's a hockey culture. It really, more than anything else, yes, Red Sox, yes, football, but even more hockey. For some reason, I think maybe because hockey players maybe still Dustin Pedroia's size, except for Chara, they really are more like people who make more or less like people earn. It's changing, I realize that. But it's not quite like the freakish size of football players and basketball players. And baseball players are as big as what football players used to be now. Hockey players look more or less like people. And I think there's a kind of hard-bitten quality, because no hockey players have any of their own teeth, and that helps. Because the hockey players have none of their own teeth, and they all have false teeth, I think that really is a very appealing to people who grew up here. They can really identify with people who really live more challenging lives.
You know, I'm with you in the sense that, you know, I have a brother who is in New Jersey, Red Sox fan. He has one daughter that's a Red Sox fan. But I'm telling other people, if you grew up in New Jersey, you grew up in New York City, don't be a Red Sox fan. I mean, hey, I love the Red Sox. I grew up a Red Sox fan. But don't be a Red Sox fan, because you'll stand out. Just like my friends when I grew up, one was a Tiger fan, one was a New York fan. Get out of here. You know what I mean? So I like that. Tell us the Johnny Pesky story that you told me the other day. I love this story. Johnny Pesky, local, lived in Swampscott, played for the Red Sox, played for the Tigers, worked with the coaching staff of the Red Sox, and so on. But here is Professor Brown and Johnny Pesky.
I am a stereotypical, credulous, ivory tower, out of touch college professor of the trope version. I believe, my wife says I'm the most gullible person she's ever met. When I find out something that everyone else knows, I'm surprised. Someone told me, a student of mine said, knew that I was going to go to the Salem Diner, which is right across the street from where we're doing this interview. This is wonderful, wonderful breakfast and lunch place. Eggs over easy. And I was about to go there and said, did you know that Johnny Pesky has breakfast there almost every day? He was older then in the late 90s, early 2000s. He was older then and wasn't traveling with the team. I said, no, I didn't know that. That's interesting. I'd love to meet the guy. Well, David Halberstam, the great writer, Power and the Glory, all these wonderful books, he wrote a book about four great Red Sox friends. The greatest of them all, of course, was Ted Williams, who Johnny Pesky described as a racehorse, as a thoroughbred. They'd have to walk him around the block a few times to calm him down before games. You know, he was just a super talented, brilliant, super talented guy that we all know. There was Pesky, Bobby Doerr, and Dom DiMaggio, those four. And Halberstam wrote this little book about those guys. And I went to see Halberstam with my wife. We went to see him give a reading. Bobby Doerr was there. And Pesky was there. Pesky was still a coach of a kind of scout coach, yeah, with the Red Sox. And I bought a couple of these books. And I wanted to get one signed for my nephew, who actually is a Yankee fan, but I thought he would really like this. He's a wonderful writer and loves baseball, and I thought it would be kind of fun, give him for his birthday. So I took myself to the Salem Diner one morning, and there was Johnny Pesky. Now, Johnny Pesky always sat in the same place in the little diner over in the back, and usually had an entourage of two or three older fellas who were around him and telling stories and enjoying it. And I saw him, I walked in, and all I wanted to do was to get Johnny to sign this book. Now, I had done some research, and this was the days before I was fully digitized, and I had the 1,100 Twitter followers that I have now. Some of the research I did, I must admit, was on baseball cards. Baseball cards taught me how to do statistics, because I used to figure out batting averages when I was little. And also, I studied Johnny Pesky's card, and I noticed, and I know that he served in World War II, missed a couple of years, as Williams did, as that greatest generation did. players. And I noticed that he was a wonderful hitter. I mean, he was a terrific hitter, but he didn't hit for power. And one year, I think he had 4 home runs. So I began to wonder about this because I was thinking about the steroid era. And I was thinking, I wonder if he was juicing. I wonder if Pesky was juicing. I was just thinking about that. And so I went in and I went over to Johnny, and there were no other people around, and he hadn't had his breakfast yet. I said, Johnny, would you – I have this book. Would you mind signing? He said, no, sit down. I sat down with him, and I said, well, I just want you to – have breakfast. So we sat there. He had chocolate milk and a couple of eggs, and – during that breakfast, I said, Johnny, listen, I want to ask you a question. You know, don't get upset. But in 1944, I think it was, you had 4 home runs. I said, were you juicing? Were you on the roids? Was this like roid anger, fury? And he just, of course, he laughed and laughed. It was just great, you know. So breakfast was over, and I figured I'm going to buy him breakfast. And the check came, and I reached in my pocket, and I looked at my wallet, and there was nothing in it. And Johnny looked at me, and he said, no. And he paid for breakfast. So I realized, oh, my gosh, now I owe Johnny a breakfast. What am I going to do? And I kept thinking about it for a long time. I would see him after that. I'd have my students in there with me, and he would look at them and he'd say, gee, I want your job, and it was very, very nice. And I never did pay Johnny back because I'm just a cheapskate, I never paid him back. And then, sadly, Johnny finally died, and I went to that wonderful things that Charles Steinberg, the PR genius for the Red Sox, does. He arranged this memorial where all these players wrote on the Pesky pole in right field. And I said to Charles Steinberg, we walked around the field, we got to do that, and I said, you know, I told him the story briefly, and I said, I owe Johnny Pesky $3.75 for breakfast, and even more, and I never get to pay him back, you know. To this day, I carry around a really deep sense of guilt about this. And as I'm talking about this, I realize I'm going to send a check. I'm going to give Bob Lobel a check. He comes to our classes. I'm going to give him a check to give to John Henry because I'm going to pay for my breakfast and Johnny's breakfast because I just don't want this on my conscience.
Well, hopefully this all works out for you sometime soon. All right, Professor Brown, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking with you and with all these insights. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah. Professor Robert Brown, Salem State University. I'm Bill Newell, and this is MSONewsSports.com.